Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
That sounded like a question.
Definitely happy about it.
What have I done to be downgraded in your eyes, Peter? That's a great shame.
I was thinking about it. It's a good question. How am I doing?
Thanks to everyone who's listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. I hope you enjoyed that Independence Day episode, which was described by listener Wild Bill Kelso as like he was watching the McLaughlin Group and Siskel and Ebert again, which is 100% the vibe this show is going for. Frankly, we could afford to be a little bit more like those shows, a little more yelly and antagonistic to each other. Maybe this is foreshadowing. Peter's like, are we friends anymore? I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. The secret sauce on Siskel and Ebert was that they actually hated each other. They really did. They like did not like each other. They were professional colleagues who had to be on a show together, but they actually really did not care for each other very much. Everyone on the McLaughlin Group hated John McLaughlin. I've got stories about that. I'll tell you after a few drinks. But we just like each other too much. We're too friendly with each other. So screw you guys. We're going to get into it this week. Speaking of conflicts, both necessary and unnecessary conflicts, onto controversies and non-troversies, where we find Seth Rogen stirring up some nonsense. But before we get to that, I want to rewind a couple years back to a podcast interview in which Seth Rogen said you shouldn't be mean to actors in reviews because it hurts their feelings. Back in 2023, Seth Rogen told an interviewer that he was professionally successful enough that virtually no one would tell him to his face that he sucked. And let's leave that aside for a moment, because I feel like that has a lot of negative consequences of certain types for some actors, maybe including Seth Rogen. But he did follow that up with a kind of interesting quote. He said, quote, "But the New York Times will write a whole article saying I suck at my job," end quote. When asked about how artists feel about criticism, Rogen said the following, quote, "I think if critics knew how much it hurts the people that made the things that they are writing about, they would second guess the way they write those things. It's devastating. I know people who have never recovered from it, honestly. A year, decades of being hurt by film reviews, it's very personal. It is devastating when you are being institutionally told that your personal expression was bad. And that's something that people carry with them, literally, their entire lives. And I get why. It fucking sucks," end quote. Mention all this because Rogen was on Ike Barinholtz's podcast the other day when, out of nowhere, the two of them started slamming Sylvester Stallone, saying that he only had 4 good movies, which Rogen may not have even granted, saying, quote, "I don't give a fuck about Rockies," end quote. Shots fired, end quote. Shots fired, etc. The general conclusion was that Stallone can't hold a candle to Arnold Schwarzenegger. This was honestly kind of a funny segment. Frankly, it got blown out of proportion a little bit by Twitter. Shocker, as it's wont. But it did make me think of that earlier interview, because on a certain level, I feel like Rogen is just as guilty of what he gets mad at critics about, right? I'm not sure that this performance is bad from a random critic is worse or meaner than one of the big figures in the industry. And Seth Rogen has a lot of power in the industry, right? He's saying this legend's entire career is shit and you're all idiots for supporting him. But what do I know? What do I know? What Rogen said 3 years ago is something we think about a lot as critics. I know, being a weekly critic myself, having pretty wide latitude in what I get to review, I will quite often simply not review an indie movie that I didn't like, because what's the point of attacking something no one knows about anyway, right? Like, these movies, sometimes they break containment, and sometimes you need to address them, right? Like, so that was the case with Uwe Boll's Citizen Vigilante, which I reviewed kind of, I would not have if not for the fact that Elon Musk had put it on his Twitter feed for 48 hours, and people were talking about it, and there was, you know, a lot of chatter. I was like, fine, if this is the zeitgeist, I'll do it. But like, I didn't see much point in attacking One Spoon of Chocolate, the new movie from the RZA, which is similarly bad, but didn't get distributed for free on Twitter for 2 days. Our responsibility is to you, the readers and listeners, not Rogen, not his compatriots. Our job is to let you make the best decision on how to spend your time and money, not to protect their feelings. Peter, how do you balance this?
Well, I used to balance it by just not ever thinking about it at all. I think when I was in my 20s and early 30s, it was just sort of like, oh, I occasionally would be aware that like a movie star or someone, you know, famous and rich would be not hurt by anything I wrote, but just sort of by the idea of somebody writing mean some stuff about them. And I would just not care at all. I was making no money. Nobody, I mean, I didn't have even a huge platform, right? And I was just like, this is irrelevant. That person, like, they can't experience a fall. Even if like even if my piece blows up, right? Even if like it actually becomes, you know, like this is going to be the like asked of them in every job interview for the next several years. Like it's still like this person's making $30 million a year. I don't care. That was my opinion. And I've changed a lot on that. And by changed, I mean, I now feel really bad when I write something mean and I do it anyway. Because the thing is, my job isn't to be nice to an actor or a director or to a screenwriter, maybe a little bit actually to a screenwriter, but like my job fundamentally is to write something that is true and that is engaging and entertaining for the reader. And that's just, you just have to put the reader first. At the same time, I'm in my 40s. And I know one thing that has happened that's a little strange in my life is like, I know people who are famous enough, not in Hollywood, but in the world of media, that they themselves are targets for often young writers who are really belligerent and really mean and really uncalled for. And in some ways, I can see from their perspective, because these famous journalists are not, for the most part, meaningfully impacted by this stuff. They barely notice it in a lot of cases. Even when they do, right, this is not affecting their compensation. This is not making them, you know, less famous. In some ways, it's making them more so because it makes them kind of objects of fixation and fascination. At the same time, I've talked to some of those people and it hurts. And they think about their reputations a lot and what people say about them. And so I have gone from being a little bit gleeful in attacking things that I think deserve to be attacked and are correct to doing it because I think that's the job. But sometimes I think, man, that was kind of mean, the thing that I wrote. Hopefully it was funny.
Hopefully it was funny. That is the number one. We do aim to entertain. You know, Alyssa, we talk about this on this show sometimes. We talked about this when Promising Young Woman was out. There was a controversy. Yeah. A critic had said something about the appearance of the lead actress in that film, and there was a lot of outrage. He got fired from his job for a while. He brought back. It's a thing I do think about a lot, and where I have kind of come down on this over the years is that, again, the responsibility is to the readers, but also, like, I do think that there is some quiet, you know, look, there are writers who love to be mean and they're often very good at their job. I'm not one of them, and I have accepted that I'm not one of them. And I do think that those are two different things and people should kind of stick with what they're best at.
Was that a question?
Yeah. Which way do you go? Do you like to be mean, or do you try to be nice to people?
Alyssa, you have like a deep niceness built into you. Even when you're mean and you're mad, you're like, you like, I know that it's like a core value of yours, niceness.
Yeah, it's something I've thought about.
We gotta be mean
time.
Sometimes because some stuff is bad.
Yeah. So it's interesting. The only time I ever met Jeff Bezos was at like a small group get together that he had with the Washington Post opinion section when I worked there. And, you know, the late Fred Hyatt, who was my boss, was talking about what he thought distinguished the section. And he said that he thought part of it was that Alexandra Petri and I were both really nice. And I spoiled that impression by immediately saying something really mean about a columnist in another paper that was about that other columnist's meanness, but was like phrased in a way that was deeply unkind. I don't like to be mean. I like to get along with people, but I just don't think that my professional obligation as someone who analyzes art and what it's about is like, you're not in service of the actors, right? You're not in service of the director, you're in service of the audience. And I think that niceness or meanness or, you know, being a tough critic, like so much of that is determined by who you think you're in service of, right? Like it's who are you writing for? Because like, it's not kind to tell someone to like spend their time or their money on something that like was produced with a lack of sort of care or interest that it reflects a kind of contempt for the audience, a kind of taking their money for granted, right? It's not like, it's not kind to think about art in, there's nothing like nice or kind to think about art in a way that's like not really engaging with it, that isn't holding it to high standards, right? I mean, these are productions. A lot of the things that we talk about, we almost never review something that's sort of micro-budgeted on that, this show, in part because we're trying to meet people where they are in the conversation. But like, what respect does it show anybody to like go easy on something that costs $170 million to make? Because why? Like, it'll, what purpose does that serve, right? And one thing I've thought about a lot over the years is the difference between sort of niceness and kindness and respect, right? Because niceness can be, you know, it can be a good quality, but it can also be bland. It can be evasive. It can be condescending. And so I try to be nice. I like to create scenarios where people are, you know, feel light, feel comfortable and engage with. But I don't think it serves anybody to just not engage with them in a serious way, right? To me, that's condescending in a way that's actually not nice. And so, you know, there's, I think, a difference between the like, oh, don't hurt, like, oh, the rich actor doesn't want me to hurt his fifis, right? And, you know, saying, hey, like, just being generally deferential to you is not actually a sign of respect. And yeah, like it, sorry, go ahead.
No. I just like, we're talking about this. And again, I'm like, maybe going to argue with myself here. But I sort of want to run something by you. We watched Superman a couple of weeks ago and Supergirl and all found it quite bad. Right. Like I might've used the word wretched. I mean, it is a bad movie in a bunch of ways. And I was not kind to it in my written review or on this show. But I was thinking about, like, I like James Gunn's work generally. Less of a fan of Craig Gillespie, though I think he has some talent that just has been misapplied. But in any case, if I was an executive, if I was even an editor brought in to sort of fix this film, right? I have to make it work in some way at some point, the stage of the process. All of us, something that connects us. I don't even know if all of our listeners know about is that we have worked as editors in journalism, which means you're giving feedback on people's work before the world has seen it. And there's a way to do that that can be even quite direct, but you're trying to build somebody up and give them the confidence to do something great. And it's a completely different approach than you take as a critic. And it's right, but it's because it's designed to get that person to feel like, look, this isn't maybe working exactly, or there are things that aren't working about this, depending on the type of the piece, or even this is working pretty well, but I think it can work better, whatever it is. But you're really trying to, you are working as a teammate with that person, and you're trying to comment in a way that is true, but also in a way that is not, it's not about serving some third party reader who you're trying to like just be very, you know, blunt, direct, and entertaining with. You're trying to get something out of them. And I would have said, if I'd seen Supergirl in an executive capacity and was given the opportunity to comment on it before release, my response would have been extremely different. Right. I would have talked, right? Like if somebody had said, we want you to come in and tell us what you think, because we're going to take that into account. And like, we'll think about your, like the things that you have to say here. I would have like, frankly, I would have said, look, let's make this a more fun, crazier movie about Lobo, right? Kind of the thing we actually said at the end. And I would have tried to pull it in a direction to make it work. And that's not what you do as a critic, but this is like, there's sort of two ways to think about this. One is, are you trying to actually reach the filmmaker and show the, and in a way that they're going to respond to? Or are you just trying to take down the thing that is in fact bad in a way that is just talking to the audience.
Well, this is another angle here that's maybe worth thinking about for a minute, because I will say that I never think about the filmmaker when I am writing about a film. I can't, for the reasons you discussed, Peter, that I just like, I kind of have to put their feelings out of my head. But I'll say, if you write something that is true about a work, particularly when it's nice, because I will say that artists are people and they like when you say nice things about what they do, and they will sometimes reach out to you. They will reach out and say, hey, thanks for noticing this thing in the thing that I made. You captured what I was going for. And my evergreen response to them is, thanks, I wasn't trying. I'm glad you appreciate it. I wasn't writing it for you. It's not my job to make you feel better about what you do. And usually they stop responding to me after that. Sometimes they will, sometimes I will write a negative thing, they'll reach out and be like, yeah, you know what? That was a thing that I wish we had done this, and blah, blah, blah. And those are also often, constructive conversations. And I almost always feel bad after getting those emails, because it's always like, well, that's a nice, thoughtful response. And I kind of wish you hadn't emailed me.
People stop emailing Sunny.
They're,
yes.
Only if you want to come on one of my podcasts. Only if you can do something for me personally. The long and the short here is that, like, as a writer, I write for the audience, like Tron in the movie Tron. I fight for the user, and you listeners are the user. So I'm Tron, basically, is what I'm saying here. I don't know. Do you think you're Tron, Peter, or are you Jeff Bridges? Who's Jeff Bridges?
Oh, I'm definitely. I'm much more Jeff Bridges than Bruce Boxleitner.
Jeff Bridges from Tron Legacy?
As much as I really loved Babylon 5 and the Bruce Boxleitner era, no, I'm definitely evil Jeff Bridges. Does it make a difference for us that we're so Sonny? You're in Texas now, but like we're on the opposite coast. Like we all started in DC, and we're on the opposite coast. And like we don't. I do sometimes get a sense reading like trade critics in particular who have some kind of social adjacency, even if they're not, directly mixing with the people that they're writing about. I do sometimes get a sense that their relationship with the filmmakers, the actors, the writers is a little bit different than it is on the East Coast, in particular writing from Washington, D.C., which, isn't. I mean, it's not like we don't have movies ever shot in D.C., but it's not even New York. That's just not a film industry to speak of in the way that there is in New York and in Los Angeles. And it means that those people are, the people who make these things are separated from us in a way that may not be true of critics who live in L.A.
Maybe. I mean, I also think if you're writing for an industry trade publication, you are writing for a different audience, right? Like you're writing for people who maybe deciding what movie to see, but you're also writing for people who work in the industry, right? Like I would review a book about, I don't know, like the, I would review the book about like the Challenger launch disaster that came out recently, Adam Higginbotham's book, differently if I was reviewing it for government executive, like for an audience of bureaucrats, yeah, than I would if I was reviewing it for a general audience. So I'm not totally sure about that. But yeah, I think like, look, if you want 2+ hours of someone's time, probably more than that because of travel to theater, and if you want $20 or more of their money, that's a big ask. And like, you can make the case to people that they can see it directly. You can make the case directly to people that they should spend their time and money that way. But I also don't think you can complain if there are intermediaries who don't have a vested interest in the project either way, who are going to help people make that decision.
Yeah. Exit question.
Yes.
What is Sylvester Stallone's best movie? Peter. Answer.
Yeah, actually. The correct answer is Rocky, but I have a real soft spot in my heart for Tango and Cash.
Alyssa.
First Blood.
That's acceptable. That's acceptable. The answer is Demolition Man is his best movie.
Okay, Demolition Man's a great movie.
Demolition Man, number one Sylvester Stallone movie. Better than Rocky. Fuck you, Rocky. I don't know, Rocky IV, maybe, which won the Cold War for America. Also very good. Also, Rambo 3 won the second Cold War. All right. But I would
the
say...
The brave Mujahideen.
I would... fake,
dedicated
fake,
to the
fake
brave
news.
Mujahideen
fake news
fighters.
That was not in the movie. You were propagating fake news. All right. That's
it's
it
a
for,
meme.
That's it for this section, which was great. Make sure to swing by movieaisle.substack.com on Thursday for a bonus episode offering up suggestions on silent movies to show your kids. If they loved the new Minions and Monsters, maybe they'll love Buster Keaton, who is referenced multiple times in Minions and Monsters. Speaking of the new Minions, on to the main event, Minions and Monsters. The Minions are back with a love letter to Hollywood history. Remember that movie Babylon? Now put Minions in it. That's Minions and Monsters, more or less. It's a movie that gives us more backstory on the nigh-on indestructible little yellow men who have served as the cronies of arch criminals through the generations. We see a tribe of minions go to work for a cyclops and then a dark wizard before settling on the evilest bosses of all, a pair of Hollywood moguls. The Minions, it turns out, were responsible for much of Hollywood's early success, huge stars of the silent era, only to find their careers completely sidetracked by the advent of sound. Again, this is like almost literally the plot of Babylon, just with like little yellow men instead of Margot Robbie and Brad Pitt and way less cocaine. After finding themselves on the outs because their gibberish pseudo-Italian does not translate into the sound era, the Minions split into two groups. One small splinter cell decides to make a brilliant monster movie with the aid of a real Cthulhu-like series of monsters. The other set goes to work for a robot from outer space who decides to take over Earth after being bullied by some Hollywood toughs during the first ever sci-fi convention, which is like taking place in a back alley. I'm not 100% sure. There's some weird stuff going on there. I gotta be honest, I don't think Minions and Monsters really works, frankly, because it does a weirdly bad job of highlighting the things the Minions are best at, which is basically Three Stooges style slapstick humor. These little guys are always the best when you put them in a silly situation and you let them hurt each other until they achieve their objective or they get bored and move on to the next thing. This movie has way too much plot. It's a movie with a plot, and that's a real mistake. It's honestly kind of a problem with the other Minions movies, too. The Minions are archetypal supporting characters. They're a spice. They're not the main course. The main course needs to be Gru coming up with his ridiculous plans in the Despicable Me series. The Minions need to be like the comic relief helping to move things along or like doing 90-second interstitial bursts of comedy. That's what they are. And these Minions movies, I'm sorry, they don't work, I don't think. I tend to judge these movies by how my kids react to them. And my kids were very quiet for long stretches of this movie. It was only in the last few minutes and then during the closing credits where they were really laughing. And they were laughing because those were the sequences in which the Minions were most Minion-like. One thing worth noting, this is very funny to me, Minions and Monsters is 91% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes with critics, which is notably higher than Minions, which was 55% fresh, and Minions The Rise of Gru, which was 70% fresh. Peter, critics, they just can't get enough of Hollywood's love of itself. Is this going to be the movie that finally wins the Minions their golden banana at this year's Oscars?
It's bizarrely like one of these Oscar bait movies about Hollywood, right? I have said, at least 10 times on this podcast, there's that great tweet about how you knew The Shape of Water was going to win the best Oscar, the best picture Oscar, the moment they all gathered together in a room and started watching a movie and bonded over it together. And it's totally true. This is a thing that they do for Oscar bait. And this movie weirdly plays like, what if we made a Minions movie, but it was Oscar bait about how great Hollywood is? What a bizarre idea. Now, it's not quite as ill-conceived as Supergirl, and I think it actually works a lot better than that movie, which was just sort of a total, like, a failure of like, design from the ground up. But it's a pretty weird movie to build a kind of complex film history with a lot of actually quite sort of obscure film references, not just to Babylon, but to actual old movies like Grand Train Robbery, some of the other stuff, right? You know, in there, the Lumiere brothers, all of that, right? This is a movie that like really, it doesn't rely on you knowing, you know, having taken film history courses in college. But I think people who have will appreciate it a lot more. And guess who's taken a lot of film history courses in college? Movie critics. What a weird thing to do. And then the other thing is, this movie is called Minions and Monsters. And yes, there's a Cyclops in the opening. But we don't get to the actual titular monsters that matter for the plot here until 45 minutes into our 90-minute movie. That little green guy who is sort of cute, but also sort of evil, he doesn't show up until the midpoint. And so we have an awful lot of kind of the minions moving first through ancient history and then through film history before we actually get to the minions fighting monsters. And while I'm not sure that I would personally have enjoyed the movie more if we'd gotten more monsters quickly, I do think the movie would have sort of sold itself better, like the pitch for this thing, the kind of the conceptual work, right? Like in screenplay theory, the second quarter of the film functionally is typically supposed to be, it's called, Blake Snyder's Save the Cat sort of screenplay structure book calls it the promise of the premise. And we don't get to the promise of the premise till midway through the movie, right? We should be having this part of the movie where like the core idea is explored needs to come up much more quickly. And so this is just an odd film on a bunch of levels.
Well, my pushback here would be, is that actually the core idea of the movie? Because the core idea of the movie seems
to be... Well, it's the second half, and it's a whole half of the film, and it's also the title.
But the core idea of the movie seems to be, hey, you know what's great is movies.
Yeah, well, they should have called it Minions and Movies. They called it Minions and Monsters.
I mean, I don't disagree with that precisely. The monsters definitely seem tertiary to everything else that's going on.
Alyssa, did this work? Do you feel like this worked as a movie for parents? Because when I was the theater I was in was almost entirely parents and kids groups. When I walked out, the kids seemed to be enjoying it. When I walked out, as the credits were still kind of rolling, I would say at least a quarter to a third, maybe even a third of the parents were literally asleep. Is that the purpose of this movie? No, it was, so, again, I saw it at 11 or 12 on a weekday, right? But like,
so I did not perhaps see Minions and Monsters with the ideal audience. I went to the tiny independent theater in my hometown for an 8:45 screening that happened to overlap with my town's fireworks display on July 2nd. And so I was literally the only person in the theater, which is just like, is a really embarrassing experience, being like a 41-year-old woman who's there without a child, where the teenage projectionist is like, you get a private showing tonight.
So did you show up as a gentle minion? Were you in your suit?
I did not show up as a gentle minion because it was 10 million degrees. So I did not perhaps see this with like in the ideal circumstances to judge whether it's an excellent family movie. I would argue, and in fact will argue in our bonus segment, that silent movies themselves are just much more engaging for families and kids than I think this movie would be. Like, you might as well just show kids the original thing as opposed to something that alludes to it if you want to introduce them to a lifelong love of film. I had never actually seen a Minions or Despicable Me movie before this, I have to confess. And so I was sort of charmed, maybe because I hadn't overloaded on the shtick before. But I don't think it's a movie that makes any sense, right? It feels much more like a collection of shorts that are sort of stapled together. And in particular, once the action gets divided between the filmmaking minions and the acolytes of the robot minions, Dort, yes. If it's going to be a movie about movies, make it about movies, right? Like, you could do much more of the weird slapstick stuff if you actually have all the minions like making a movie, right? I don't understand why we go, if you want to do a series of shorts that you kind of staple together, if you want to make like what's essentially like a series of Nickelodeon short movies, I can see that having been really charming, right? And it would have actually been really interesting to go through more of film history, right? Like, what is the Minions version of like Frank Capra's Why We Fight movies? What does Minions Screwball look like? What's Minions Easy Rider? Minions Star Wars, right? Like, you know, Minions like French New Wave. I actually think like that version of things is like a series of sketches. I would find that totally delightful, and maybe they will like, maybe they'll take my suggestion and release that on a DVD edition. But like as a movie, this doesn't make any sense at all. Also, look, why is there an alien? And also, why is the alien like hanging? Why is the alien going to science fiction conventions? Like,
I have a lot of questions about what minions actually are and how they work, right? So like the minion, the whole
and
concept
did they
of
work for Hitler, right? Like this the whole, is the key
well, no,
thing.
So
it's like,
this
did
is,
the minions
this is
work
addressed
for Hitler?
In one. This is addressed in one of the previous films. During World War II, they were very conveniently asleep for the whole time. They were in a
Why?
Cave. They were in a cave sleeping.
But aren't there multiple minion tribes? Did like all
well,
the minion
yes,
tribes
this
gather
is a new
for a
wrinkle.
Convention?
This is a new wrinkle that was introduced in this film. As my daughter, as my keen-eyed daughter said, this is a new thing. I didn't know there were multiple tribes of minions. And I was like, you know what? That's right. That's a good point. I did not even think about that. This movie does introduce the concept of multiple competing tribes of minions. You think there would be Hitler minions.
I think for studio branding purposes, minions and Hitler is the wrong way to go. Like, I'm not recommending that.
I don't know, man.
Maybe,
minions
maybe
in movies.
Maybe this is why not Werner Heisenberg, like, misunderstanding physics, but actually like the minions being not particularly competent is why the U.S. wins the race to the atomic bomb.
You could do
minions and Hitler and have the minions be the heroes.
Well, so this is my big question about minions, right? Is like, what, like, do they gravitate towards a particular type of evil, right? Because you would think like, all right, here are planet destroying monsters that are going to, like, shouldn't they be minioning for the monsters? Shouldn't they actually be like the minions of the Cthulhu monsters? Like,
had artistic dreams that superseded their desire to work for the big boss.
But the other minions happily work for the robot who proclaims his desire to take over the world and enslave humanity. Like, I just
but
don't understand
really
why do they want to why do they want to work for some but not others? Like, where is the minion line? Where does that get drawn, aside from Hitler? What brand of evil? Maybe this is addressed in one of the other. I don't think I've seen all of the Despicable Me movies, but I've seen a fair number of them over the years, thankfully. It's one of the real joys of this job.
Fact check. Could the minions have worked for Mao? Were they awake by then?
Again, I think
minions
that they were...
Mao?
The minions are very notoriously absent during much of the 20th century's conflicts. There's no minions, working. Maybe the minions were working for Stalin. I can't remember. I can't remember if they were running the gulags. Because that
they
would
fight
be funny.
The Vietnam
that
War?
Would,
is it minions and MacArthur?
The minions running the gulags would be very funny. Just imagine.
Minions and McNamara. Minions and McNamara.
So anyway, I have a lot of questions about what minions, I have a lot of questions about the ethos of minioning. Like, I think that there's a lot of unanswered questions here.
Are they immortal?
Yes. So this is another thing. Can they die is a question I have about the minions all the time. And I do think this is answered in one of them. Maybe somebody can tell us in the comments, but like they are often being injured in fairly graphic and gratuitous ways, and none of them ever seem to suffer any sort of real injury. It's not clear.
Well, they're
to
very
me
obviously.
That
if you've played like Bethesda style role playing games, there are companion characters that follow you around and get in fights with you and help you out in fights. And at the end of the fight, if they get their life depleted to a certain point, they go into a crouch mode and can't help you. But then when the fight's over, they're just to back because they're plot relevant characters that can't be killed. And those characters are functionally kind of more individualistic minions for you, the hero or bad guy of the role playing game journey. They function like that pretty clearly.
I will say, set all these questions aside. Have you guys seen Babylon? Did we do an episode on Babylon?
We did Babylon for the show.
We did Babylon on the show. That's right. And I will say that, like, I actually, to your point, Alyssa, I actually would really enjoy the, like, you remember the Babylon montage that's like the history of technological innovation? That if this movie had just been that, I think it would have been so much better. Also, like, your point about if this is going to be a movie about making movies, you know what movies take? Movies take giant crews. Crews got to do a lot of different things on a movie. You know, they've got lots of different jobs. They're all very specialized. It sounds like the perfect thing for minions to be doing. There should have been minions all over that set with lights and cameras and microphones and whatever. And instead,
Perhaps working for the big boss, the movie director, right?
Yeah.
Because a movie director is a kind of boss, you know, a supervillain, right? A Gru type who can be. Certainly there's a type of director who projects that image, right? There's legends of this, you know, historically. This movie, as far as I can tell, they were sitting around trying to figure out what they wanted to do. And they said, you know, like somebody offhandedly said, well, they're like silent film stars, right? And it's kind of true. They're like silent film stars. They don't really say much, right? There's occasionally they're in their gibberish, a word or two comes through, but functionally they don't talk. They're just creatures of physical comedy, Buster Keaton-like. And so as far as I can tell, like my sense of how this movie was conceived was they're silent film stars. Wouldn't it be funny if, and then a bunch of other stuff that became this movie. But because it's a fantasy world, they wanted fantasy bad guys. So we get this whole thing with the magic book of the Lovecraftian monsters that then turn out to be cute, but also still evil, and the science fiction stuff because, we're in a genre world. So we need to mix that in. And also we didn't even talk about the fact that Dort is dating a women's rights,
a suffragette.
Because that's what four-year-olds like are fascinated by is film history and like gender politics of the early 1900s. Yeah. Okay, Alyssa, that might have been true of you, but
what can I say?
I don't know.
It's cute.
I found this movie disappointing. I wanted more hot minion action, frankly, and this movie doesn't have enough hot minion action in it.
I mean, part of the problem is that the truth is that the minions are not like silent film stars. They're like the Three Stooges.
Well, this is actually the thing is that they're not silent film stars, right? Is that they are like they are like slapstick, Three Stooges style. Anyway, it doesn't, isn't it? I don't know. One last thing, just on a business note, I am surprised by how poorly this is doing. This is not playing well, which is kind of surprising to me. It's the worst opening for the series. I think 65 million over 5 days, something like that, which is a really bad number.
It's going to make money. I'm a little surprised, but I'm also, this movie is, I think, a conceptual misfire. Again, not in the way that Supergirl was, but we're going to make your description up front is really correct. We're going to remake Babylon, a movie that underperformed and was too expensive, and also I liked it, and it's incredibly technically proficient, but just really kind of up its own ass in terms of like the way that it's worshipful of Hollywood, right? And we're gonna remake that, a movie that not many people saw, but
for kids,
for 4-year-olds with little yellow guys.
Yeah, it's real strange.
I just think this movie would have succeeded much more if it had more elephants. There's really only that brief shot of the elephants. This movie needed more elephants and more cocaine. All right. The cinema score on this one, it's interesting. First Minions, A. Second Minions, Minions, The Rise of Gru, A. This one, A-. So audiences did not seem to like it as much, which is, again, not surprising because it's not very good.
Targeted at movie critics. That was a mistake.
Yeah, we are the worst. Look, we talked about how mean we are, how mean critics are to writers, but frankly, people should be meaner to movie critics, including us. Yell at us in the comments.
I will say it was very funny to watch this movie while reading the galleys for David Thompson's new book, A Sudden Flicker of Light, which is sort of a revisionist history of the movies. And I'm not all the way through it, so I don't feel prepared to issue a final judgment on it, but it's just like, as a series of sort of vignettes about the movies that kind of come together in a larger argument about the form, I would recommend, I'm not sure I would recommend David Thompson for a four-year-old over Minions and Monsters, but it's definitely better if you're an adult.
I'm also reading that, and it's pretty good. But also, I might have more on it later. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Minions and Monsters? Peter?
Sadly, thumbs down. This is a movie made for kids, but also from 40-year-old movie critics, and they needed to pick one or the other. And I think they should have picked the kids.
Alyssa?
Thumbs down, and not only if you're seeing it as a 40-year-old, in a 41-year-old in your hometown theater all by yourself.
Thumbs down. I think my kids, I asked them, I was like, did you like that? And they were like, yeah, that was pretty good, I guess. And I was like, oh, that is not a ringing endorsement from my kids. So I will join them in saying thumbs down. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at r-restore. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.